You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Let's finish out. Exodus 24, verse 14. Moses said to the elders, "Wait here for us," that's him and Joshua, "until we come back to you. Aaron and Hur are in charge, and anyone involved in a dispute can go to them." So, verse 18, Moses entered the cloud as he went up to the mountain, and he stayed on the mountain for 40 days. That's 6 weeks. That's a month and a half. He's gone. Mount Sinai, nowhere to be found. An innumerable amount of Israelites are sitting there at the bottom of the mountain, doing what? Waiting. Where did he go? He said he's coming back. We don't know when. I'm not sure when. And they didn't know it was going to be 40 days. It wasn't like they could say, all right, May 15th, he's going to be back. They don't know when he's going to return. So we jump ahead to Exodus 32. This is where the narrative picks back up. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and they said to Aaron, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's even happened to him." So the people were waiting so long, 6 weeks down there at the bottom of the mountain, and they don't know what happened to Moses. They don't know what's going on. And they're saying, you got to do something here. Notice the nomenclature here. It wasn't the Yahweh God brought them out of Egypt. Moses. They've ascribed all of the power and the potency to Moses, and he's not here. So our leader's gone, and if the leader's away, the mice will play. And so we're going to go do our own thing. Make us gods, Elohim. This could be a language used for God himself. Elohim is used for God. In the Hebrew, Eloi means powerful, and the im suffix means plural. It's like adding an es, s. So Elohim, make us gods. This could be either God or this could be plural gods. The verb here is plural. So they're saying, make us some deities. Aaron, the weakling, in verse 5 says, "Tomorrow we will celebrate a festival to Yahweh." It's unclear as to whether he's trying to smush together worship in Yahweh with worship in polytheism, some kind of a syncretism, synchronizing polytheism and monotheism, whatever it is, this could be that he's going to create something which he believes to be Yahweh God. So he answers them, "Take off the gold earrings that your wives, sons, your daughters are wearing and bring them to me." Where did these nomads, these former slaves, get this gold? Exodus says in Exodus 12:46, they received it right from the Egyptians. Remember, they plundered them. They took this gold. Then they took it out and built the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant. And they also built this project, which we're about to read. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol. Good God, we just read about this in Exodus 20. No graven images, no idols, no gods before me. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. I don't know why it's a golden calf. Don't ask me. I don't know. It doesn't say. Maybe they thought bull, something that strong. If you're picking a mascot, you don't pick an aardvark. You pick a calf or something. I don't know. But they pick a calf, a cow, a bull, something strong. Then they said to Aaron, "These are your gods who brought you up out of Egypt." Idolatry. Aaron built an altar in front of the calf and he announced, "Tomorrow we will celebrate a festival to Yahweh." So the next day, the people rose early. They sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings afterward. So this seems pretty harmless at this point, doesn't it? Pretty innocuous. You're just building a calf, and God said, don't do it. And we don't really know why. You can't have other gods, and you can't make graven images. And yet, we read in verse 6, afterward, they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in pagan revelry. Revelry, what does that even mean? I'm a big fan of translating what the text says, not using words that we don't even know what they mean. When's the last time you used the word revelry in a sentence? Revelry, sahak. Isaac, Sahak, his wife. Revelry. He was caressing his wife. Joseph was allegedly, he was accused of making sport of Potiphar's wife. What's that mean? Sex. That's what that means. Sex. Caressing his wife. Sexing his wife. Joseph sexing Potiphar's wife. Walter Kaiser says this is, quote, drunken, immoral orgies and sexual play, conjugal caresses, which is somehow creepier than immoral orgies, conjugal caresses. Anyone who says conjugal caresses is no longer my friend. Anyhow, so creepy. The Lord said to Moses, go down because, look at the pronouns here, your people, whom you brought out of Egypt, have become corrupt. He's been gone for 6 weeks, a month and a half, and they've already built a golden calf, and there is an all-out drunken orgy at the bottom of the mountain, and God says, these are now your people. I have disowned them. Leave me alone that my anger may burn against them and I may destroy them. Then I will make you, Moses, into a great nation. God could have done this if we were to speak in the hypothetical, the subjunctive. God made a promise with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but Moses was an heir of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he's from the clan of the Levites. So God could have rebuilt a nation through him. And it could have been a little bit tempting for Moses with the way that these people had treated him since the Exodus had begun to occur. All of the flack that he took, the pain, the misery, the doubt, the accusation. And it's not over. We're going to see for the next 40 years, these people try and kill him on multiple occasions. Imagine trying to kill somebody who's trying to lead you. And God's saying, we could wipe these people out. We could start over with you. Tempting, very tempting. And, might I add, fully just. Fully just. But Moses sought the favor, the grace of the Lord his God. Lord, he said, why should your anger burn against your people, whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Okay, you saved these people, he's saying. Why should the Egyptians say, it was with evil intent that he brought them out, to kill them in the mountains and to wipe them off the face of the earth? There's a lot of gods in the ancient Near East, aren't there? And there's even some powerful gods. The Egyptians believed in these. But they also believed in capricious gods, gods that would plan one thing and then completely switch around and do the opposite the next second. And so Yahweh is just one of those deities. He's powerful. He showed his might. But at the same time, he brings them out here just to kill these people. And Moses is saying, God, your reputation with the world is at stake. That is the basis on which he's appealing. Turn from your fierce anger. Relent. Do not bring the disaster on your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to whom you swore by your own self, I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. I will give your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever. Too many scriptural citations to quote here. We see all the way back in Genesis 12, verse 7. Again, it's ratified in verse 15. And then again in chapter 18 of the book of Genesis. And then with Isaac, then with Israel, Jacob. It says on and on. God is saying, I'm going to make a nation through you and give you this real estate in Israel. So Moses is appealing to God's own love, God's own reputation, and finally, God's own promise with the Abrahamic promise, the Abrahamic covenant. So the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he would do to his people. Okay, this passage really, really got me into a tizzy years ago. I was a new believer, and I was reading my Bible. I had a buddy who was into what's called open theism. You might not know what that is. These people are believers in the Bible, but they say that God doesn't know the future because free will dictates that these events don't have truth value. We don't know what's going to happen if they're truly free in the libertarian sense. We don't know what you're going to choose. So God knows everything, but he doesn't know things that are unknowable. So God doesn't know the future. Open theism. And my buddy was an open theist, and he showed me this passage right here. The Lord changed his mind. Moses spoke to God, and God, not being omniscient, all-knowing, God changed what he was going to do based on the words of a man. I didn't know what to do with this. Do you know what to do with this passage? God changed his mind based on the words of Moses. So he didn't know this was going to happen. He was going to do one thing, and then Moses jumps in, and all of a sudden God says, oh, okay, I guess we'll do your plan. So God goes with that. I was stuck in the mud. I didn't know what to say. He said, what do you do with this? But I didn't know what to say. Luckily, I've studied since then. God didn't change his mind in the sense that he didn't know any of this was going to happen. For one, oh, I wish I had known this at the time. The context. What did Moses tell him? Any new information? No. He said, God, I'm basing this on your reputation with the Egyptians. God knew that. He doesn't need to know the future to know that. I'm basing this on the Abrahamic covenant. That's 500 years, half a millennium years old. God knew that. You don't need to know the future. It's not like Moses told him, oh, you need to consider something you've never considered. God knew everything that Moses told him. So what's going on here? Here's what's going on. When God said, I'm going to go judge these people, this wasn't an immutable decree. Mutate means to change. Immutable means you don't change. There are some things where God says, I am going to do something and you can't change my mind. Immutable. Immutability. True. This isn't one of those decrees. It isn't. We read it for ourselves. He just said, this is what I'm planning to do. We see the same thing in Amos 7. Jonah. Think about Jonah. He goes into the city in 40 days. Nineveh will be destroyed. And yet the people have a change of heart. And they come out on the other side with a change of heart. And God says, all right, I won't destroy you. Oh, God didn't know that? No. He was making a threat, a judgment, and the people changed, so he changed. 3. This is anthropomorphic language. That's a big word. Anthropos means human, and morphe means form, morphology, form. So this is language in the form of what humans would use. For example, let's say we were listening to a meteorologist, and she said that the sun rises at 7.05 a.m. Stupid woman. She believes that the sun moves? Hasn't she gone to college? She calls herself a meteorologist. She's on ABC6 in the morning, and I'm supposed to be drinking my coffee and believing in her. She believes in a geocentric Earth. Is that what? No, it's anthropomorphic language. It's not that the sun moves. It's that we move around it. And yet, from a human-centric point of view, the sun is the one that is rising. It's moving. Illustration. I am to the left of the stool. I am to the right of the stool. Did the stool move? You said no? Correct. She said no. She's right. You all were wrong, and she was right. No, the stool did not move. I moved, and it stayed in the same place. God, in a sense, didn't change. But from Moses' perspective, he's saying, I'm to the left of the stool. Now I'm to the right of the stool. What changed? Not God. God didn't change. What changed? Moses' prayer. This word changed his mind. Naham is an onomatopoeia. Naham. Boop. Drip. Plop. Naham. It means to be sorry, to be moved with pity, to be moved with, oh man, I'm so sorry to hear Naham. So sorry to hear that. Naham. To change your mind is to relent, to be filled in your heart. Psalm 90 is the only place to use this word in the same Hebrew form, and it means to be sorry, to have pity. Finally, the circumstances changed. God's attitude towards evil is always justice. God's attitude toward repentance or a change of heart is always mercy. So we could say, well, God changed. No, he did not. The situation changed, and consequently, God stayed the same to his character. This is what we refer to as a divine drama, where God knows everything that's happening, but he knows that an intercessor is going to show up. His character is the same. The intercessor prays. Now, how does all this work? How does our prayer really matter? The prayer of a righteous man accomplishes much. You do not have because you do not ask. And yet God is totally and completely in control of the universe. How does that all work? I don't have a clue. It's a mystery to me. When you figure it out, let me know. All I know is our responsibility is important and God is completely and utterly sovereign. That being said, Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the covenant law in his hands. They were inscribed both on the front and the back. Two tablets. Why were there two? 10 commandments on one, 10 commandments on the other. One was for God, one was for the people. Like you would have a contract today. You would sign it, and then you'd have a copy for the landlord and copy for you guys. God had his copy. Moses and the people had theirs. Two tablets. When Joshua heard the noise of the people shouting, remember what's going on at the bottom of the mountain? Remember? Hear the people shouting. He said to Moses, there's a sound of war in the camp. Moses replied, that ain't war. It's not the sound of victory, he says. It's not the sound of defeat. It's the sound of singing that I hear. That's not a war. That's an orgy. That's no moon. That's a space station, right? When Moses approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, literally the writhing around, his anger burned. He took the tablets out of his hands, broke them into pieces at the foot of the mountain. This is the place in Exodus 19 where the people met God. This is like on their honeymoon. They're committing adultery. This is the spot right here. It's been 6 weeks, and here they are with a freaking orgy going on, and Moses comes down. It's one thing to hear it and to intercede for the people, but then you see it, and he just crashes this out. He took the calf, the golden calf the people had made, and burned it in the fire. Good move. He ground it into a powder, then he scattered it on the water, and Moses made the Israelites drink it. It's like your dog. You peed there? Get over here. Smell it. Why did he make them drink it? Because it permanently destroyed this idol. That's why. When you ground up the gold in the water and they drink it and digest it and defecate it, nobody's going to be worshiping that gold anymore. No one's going back to that. And it showed that this idol was completely effete. It was completely powerless. We see the same thing in the book of Isaiah, chapter 44-ish. You know, you got a piece of wood, Isaiah says. Good, good for you. Got a piece of wood. And you cut it in half, and you cook your dinner with the one half of the wood, and then you make an idol, and you bow down and worship the other half. It's a polemic. It's an argument against idolatry. You're taking a piece of wood, and you're making dinner, and then you're worshiping it. Which is it? Is it something that you worship, or something that makes your mac and cheese at night? And Isaiah's making that argument. And Moses is doing the same thing. You're worshiping this golden calf that's completely powerless. Look, I came down, I smashed it, I made you drink it. Moses said to Aaron, remember Aaron, his brother, his big brother? Aaron, what did these people do to you that you led them into such great sin? He had left Aaron in charge. Aaron, what happened? I left you in charge for 6 weeks. This is what happens. Okay, don't be Aaron. Definitely don't be Aaron. Don't be angry, my Lord, Aaron answered. You know how prone these people are to evil. I would score some points with Moses. He knows that, yeah? They said to me, make us gods who will go out before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us out from Egypt, we don't even know what happened to him. That happened too. Moses is deciding, or rather, Aaron is deciding what happened. So I told them, whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off. Oh, I bet at this point, Aaron was thinking, I spoke too much. I shouldn't have told him this part. I told him to take off the gold jewelry. Then again, how did they get the golden calf? I had to explain this part. Well, then I told them, give me the gold. And I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. It's amazing. the most amazing thing you've ever seen in your life. That's the worst excuse you've ever heard, ever, ever. That, I've had some bad excuses in my day. I went to a Ray LaMontagne concert. Great singer. God, is he great. Went to the concert. I put a little container of alcohol in the back of my pocket behind my wallet. Made it stick out real far, too. I went through the security, and they're like looking at me, and the one woman was like, "What's that?" And I'm like, I want to see the show. Please let me through. And she's like, "Step off. You got to get frisked." So I'm like, "Oh, God." I felt like I was in middle school again. So I went off to the side, and the guy patted me and felt on my butt, and that didn't feel that great. But he touched me, and then I turned to him, and he looked at me, and he turned back to the woman, and he said to the woman, "He has two wallets." And so I turned to the woman, and I was like, "Yeah." Dude, what kind of a psychopath carries two wallets? This psychopath, that's who. All right. Bad excuses. Moses doesn't buy this at all. He saw the people were running wild. Aaron had let them get out of control, become a laughingstock to their enemies. So he stood at the entrance to the camp, and he said, "Listen, whoever is for the Lord, come to me." This is where you're drawing the line in the sand. You're saying, okay, we got the big, you know, golden calf worshiping group, orgiastic worship, and we got other people that are for God. If you're for God, come to me. All the Levites rallied to Moses. He was a Levite, so they came to him. Then he said to them, "This is what the Lord says." Now catch this. "Each man strap a sword to his side. Go back and forth throughout the camp from one end to the other with your sword, each killing his brother and friend and neighbor." The Levites did just as Moses had commanded. In that day, about 3,000 people died. Whew. Boy, if you're reading this in your time in the morning, you'd be thinking, makes sense, except for you get to this part. 3,000 people died. Let me open up with a question. And I don't mean for this to be insensitive in any way. Why only 3,000? Why only 3,000? If the point here is that they're just supposed to kill every one of their relatives and friends and neighbors, then why are there only 3,000 who were in a corporate capital punishment killed? Why only 3,000? Now, under any estimate, there are an innumerable number of Israelites here. Why a small subsection? When we read verse 31, Moses says there's still Israelites there. Not everyone was killed, in other words. That's my point. My point is this. Not everyone was killed. Why? Why were some people killed and some people weren't? The hardcore remnant refused to change. What this means is not that you go and you find your brother in the crowd and you kill him. You find your neighbor, you kill her. You find your relative, you kill him or her. That's not the point. It's to be indiscriminate with justice. Indiscriminate with justice, even if it's your brother, even if it's your relative, your neighbor. And going back and forth throughout the camp. Why back and forth? Why not just go through? The point here is that some people there were saying, no, we are staying with this perverse, totally debauched, orgiastic worship of an idol. And we don't care what you say. And they were doubling down and saying, no. And the people were saying, we are coming in here to judge. Are you with God or not? And these people were saying, And the people are going, all right. And think about that, looking around and seeing 3,000 people go down. How stubborn and hardcore do you have to be sticking to your own orgiastic worship, to see people getting executed, judged, and just to stand there and say, no, I refuse to change. Really, the question here is not the gravity of the punishment. The gravity of the punishment is the same as the gravity of the crime. How serious is idolatry? How serious is this? We see that within moments, they are worshiping this idol. Orgies, all sorts of stuff. Within hundreds of years, we see the idol worship in the ancient Near East. Archaeologically speaking, I'm not saying from the Bible. Archaeologically speaking, there was ritual prostitution and rape of women where Baal, the god, the fertility god, would dress up, a man would dress up as Baal, and he would have sex with a ritual prostitute, Asherah. And he would have sex with her to kind of get the gods, Baal and Asherah in heaven, to bring fertility on the land. And this was just widespread sexual assault. We also have from archaeology, idols with their hands held out, cooking embers underneath, and newborn babies being thrown onto the hands of the idol, Kronos. We have the little bones of the babies underneath that idol. How serious is idolatry? You think of how evil human beings can be. What happens when they deify themselves in an idol? It gets even more perverse and twisted. And God was saying, no, 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 stop right there. Took a very hard line. The next day, Moses said to the people, you have committed a great sin. That's for sure. But now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. So Moses went back to the Lord and he said, oh, what a great sin these people have committed. They have made themselves gods of gold. But now, please forgive their sin. But if not, blot me out of the book that you have written. Take me. These are the people who have betrayed Moses. These are the people that don't deserve it. And Moses is saying, if you're going to judge anyone, you take me, throw me into hell so that they can go to heaven. Is God going to accept that? A righteous man like Moses standing in for a mass of people. Is God going to say, well, I'll accept your offer? The Lord replied, whoever has sinned against me, that is the one I'm going to blot out of my book, not you. So he doesn't accept it. Yeah, that makes sense. Moses is just a man. How could one man substitute for that many? You can't do that. I can't substitute for you. I'm not sinless, and it's only one man substituting for another. Moses is saying, I'm going to substitute for all the people. Well, those are delusions of grandeur. You can't do that. A man can't do that. Nice thought, but no, I won't accept it, God says. Now go lead the people to the place I spoke of, and my angel is going to go before you. However, when the time comes for me to punish, I will punish them for their sin. And the Lord struck the people with a plague because of what they did with the calf Aaron had made. There's still people left. The plague, non-lethal, maybe a little COVID-19, something like that. I don't know what he gave them, but something that was bad. Maybe I shouldn't have joked about COVID-19. Too soon? Too soon. Okay. I'll note that. All right. What led to this serious fall? Let's see if we can draw this together. Chapter 32. What led to this here? The impetus for how this all began, the first domino that was flicked over, was that the people were told that they needed to wait. How long? They didn't know. And at the time, that probably felt like a long time. You're sitting there at the bottom of this mountain. Where's Moses? I don't know. When's he coming back? Not sure. Who's in charge? Aaron. What are we supposed to do? And then the days turn into weeks. Week one, week two, week three. What are we doing here? Kicking the sand, you know, sitting around. Where's God? Well, where are we doing? Where are we going? I thought we were going to the promised land. Moses said he had to go up there. I don't know why. Why is he up there? I don't know. He's up there for some reason. And they're just sitting around waiting. God, do I hate waiting. Hate it. You ever had one of those things that you have to do in the future and you're scared about it? Wouldn't you just like to get it over with? And yet just to sit there and wait day after day, week after week. Oh, man, mind-numbing. Scary. Makes you lose sleep. Aggravating. Makes you angry, irritable. What are you waiting on in your life right now? What are you waiting on? What is something that you've waited, you know, it could be a spouse. could be God, you know, blessing your life in some way to make an influence on another person. I don't know. I don't know what you're waiting on. All I know is that the Bible says if you're into God, you're into waiting. You got to wait. And during these times, waiting brings big questions into our minds. Like, how long? God, I'm following you. I love you. I put you first in my life. This thing that I'm praying for, it's a good thing. It's not like it's something that's bad. I'm not asking for a Maserati here, anything like that. All I want to do is to be able to make an impact for you. I'm praying for that daily. What is going on? How long is this going to last? Am I going to pray for this for a year? Two? Three? How long is this going to go on? And then we start to see God answering prayers in other people's lives. And we start to think to ourselves, wait a minute. I've been praying every day. That knucklehead over there, they haven't been doing anything. In fact, they've got all sorts of problems. They're relationally immature. I know all their issues. And God is blessing them over and over and over. And why? Why them? I've seen this as a third party. I'll see two different people. And one person, I'm like, I know that person is a godly person. They love God. This other person over here, I've got my doubts. I don't really know. And yet God blesses them? Why? Why does he do that? Why would he do that? Oh, man, waiting. This gets under your skin. And it leads to a question, is this something I should just put in my own hands? There are some people sitting right here who won't be here in a year. And this is why, right here. Because, you know, I could wait on what God's going to provide for me, or I could just go out and get it myself. And that is the battle that we wrestle with deep in our soul. What I think I need is to go out and get laid. I need to go get high. I need to go get drunk, something like that. And God's like, well, hold on a second. I got a great life. I want to give you joy and give it abundantly. John 10:10. But you want to go for a cheap shortcut. You know? God's like, you got to wait. When you wait, major changes occur deep in your soul. People can't see it. Many of these things are between just you and God. It's pressure. When are we going to see this come through? Pressure. Why hasn't God answered? Pressure. Why can't this be expedited? Pressure. And it's like the guy or the girl going into the CrossFit gym, putting weight on the dumbbell. Pressure on that muscle, trying to tear that muscle so that it heals and comes back even stronger. And it's during these times that it hurts. I'm not going to lie to you. It hurts. And yet, when you come through to the other side of these times of waiting, you look back and you go, what was I complaining about? God was so good to me. He taught me so much. As one person said, I'm more thankful for the prayers that God did not answer than the prayers that he did, because I wasn't ready to receive them at the time. Yeah, we got to wait. When we refuse to wait and we stomp our foot in an infantile way and say, now, I want it now, right now, God makes us wait a little bit longer. Sometimes we actually prolong this in a way that becomes interminable. God is saying you got to wait. And I don't know what you're waiting on, but you do. It's worth the wait. You have to wait. And when you break through this, you're going to see the goodness of God in new ways you never saw before. Well, the people refused to wait and got an idol. They had to drink it. What about Moses? He chose to wait and see God. Oh, that's interesting. Contrast. They refused and they said, we're going to put this in our own hands, do it ourselves. Moses said, no, I'm going to wait. What's he get? Chapter 33, Moses used to take a tent and pitch it outside the camp some distance away. He called it the tent of meeting. This is kind of a proto-tabernacle, which we studied last week. Anyone inquiring of the Lord would go to the tent of meeting outside the camp. And whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people rose and stood at the entrances to their tents, watching Moses until he entered the tent. Oh, they knew. There's no more questioning Moses at this point. They know Moses is with God. And when God would go meet with Moses, they would look over and be like, there he is again. God meets with him, and he's meeting outside the camp. What's that communicate? I'm no longer with you. I'm with him. As Moses went into the tent, the pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance of the tent while God spoke with Moses. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as one speaks to a friend. That should make us pause right there. You can have your golden idol, calf, or you can speak with the living God face to face as one speaks with a friend. Moses said to the Lord, apparently he would talk to God, they'd have conversations. He said, you've been telling me, lead these people, but you haven't let me know whom you're going to send with me. You've said, I know you by name, and you've found favor with me. If you're pleased with me, teach me your ways so I may know you and continue to find favor with you. Remember that this nation is your people. And the Lord replied, my presence will go with you. Do you see the tension here? It's outside the camp. And God, earlier he said, we skipped over this. God said, I'm not going to go with your people. Moses says, go with us. And he says, my presence will go with you. Huh? And I will give you rest. I will do the thing that you've asked because I am pleased with you and I know you by name. Yeah, God knows every one of us right here in this room by name. And he's pleased with you. You could put your name right in here. I am pleased with you, Katie. I know you by name. I'm pleased with you, Mike. I know you by name. I will do the thing that you have asked. Then Moses said, now show me your glory. Now at this point, would you have the audacity to ask for more? God says, my presence will go with you. I know you by name and I'm pleased with you. And Moses says, show me your glory. You know what this is? This is understanding that God is a giver. God loves this. He gives and he gives and he gives more. Well, the Lord said, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I'll have mercy on whom I have mercy. I'll have compassion on whom I have compassion. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. Do you see the tension? They spoke face to face in one sense, but then he says, show me your glory. And he goes, I'll show you my goodness. You can't see me face. It'd be like taking a spaceship a mile away from the sun. You would just incinerate. But, God said, you cannot see my face. No one may see me and live. Then the Lord said, there is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in the cleft of a rock, and then I'll cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand, and you will see my back, but my face you may not see. This is, how do you describe this? God's glory, his goodness going by, his after effects. Maybe when we speak of the tail of a comet, we don't mean a vestigial tail of an animal or something like that. We mean that it's the end of the comet, the after effects, the light from the comet. God's glory goes by and he says, I'll show you my back, my after effects. That's all you can withstand. This is an idiom. To see God's back is to see nothing at all, virtually. God is showing him something, otherwise he wouldn't put him in the cleft of a rock. But he's saying, to show you my face, that would be grabbing the electrical lines and holding on too long. You can't do that, but I'll give you a little bit to see. We jump down to 34. The Lord came down in the cloud, and he stood there with Moses and proclaimed his name, the Lord. God passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, Yahweh, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. You know, God doesn't give any description of who he is or what he looks like. Unimportant. Instead, he tells us what he is. Five things: compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, loving, faithful. He will continue to maintain love to thousands, forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Three different ways. wickedness, rebellion, sin. He's a forgiver. He's a lover. Yet, see the tension? Yet, he does not leave the guilty unpunished and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the covenant law in his hands, he was not aware, but his face was radiant because he had spoken with the Lord. He saw something. I don't know what those after effects looked like, but his face was lit up. When Aaron and all the other Israelites saw Moses, his face was radiant. The people were afraid to come near. Literally, the language here is that his face shone beams of light. It was shooting off of his face. Exodus 24 says that God's face looked like a consuming fire. And so Moses has something like that on his face, molten lava, beams shooting off of his head. I don't know, but the people are like, what on earth? They're scared to come near him. But Moses called to them. So Aaron and the leaders of the community came back and they spoke to them. Afterward, all the Israelites came near and he gave them all the commands that the Lord had given to him on the mountain. When Moses finished speaking to them, he put a veil over his face because it was just too shocking for the people. But whenever he entered the Lord's presence to speak with the Lord, he used to remove the veil until he came out. Moses came out and told the Israelites what he had been commanded. The people saw that his face was radiant. Then Moses would put the veil back over his face until he went in to speak with the Lord. And there we have the book of Exodus. Did you see the tensions that I saw reading through this? The tensions, the irreconcilable, seemingly irreconcilable tensions in the text. For one, judgment and atonement. On the one hand, Moses says, I want to make atonement. I want to somehow get in God's presence and forgive the people. I even want to be a substitute. Take me. Blot me out of your book. But God wouldn't accept the intercession of a man. The people, on the other hand, deserve judgment. God says that my wrath is burning. But Moses steps in as a mediator and prays for them, and God changes his mind. So, judgment and atonement. Which one wins out? Is God going to be forgiving and loving, or is he going to be judging and wrathful? Or two, separation versus imminence. On the one hand, God cannot be with the people on their travel. He says, I'm not going to go with you. He says, the tent needs to be out there. You're here. I'm out there in the tent. No one can see me and live. And he says that even Moses, you can only see my after effects. At the same time, God promised to go with his people, with his presence. And he wants to show Moses his glory. Which is it? You see what I'm saying? The tension. Oh, the tension is rife in this text. Judgment or atonement? Separation or closeness? Third, love or justice? God is deeply loving. He says, I'm compassionate. I'm loving. I'm gracious. I forgive wickedness, trespasses, etc. And yet he's deeply, deeply just. Which is it? If you were to read your Hebrew Bible and close it at the end, at the book of Malachi, you would be left with these insuperable problems. I mean, on the one hand, God is loving. On the other hand, God is just. Which is it? I don't know. It's a mystery. On the one hand, God is totally separate from us. On the other hand, he wants his presence to be near us. God is a God of justice and judgment, but then again, he's a God of atonement. How do you reconcile these things together? At the end of the Old Testament, you have no answer. You do not. This is only revealed through the person and the work of Jesus. At the cross of Christ, we have the judgment of God coming down on Jesus and also Jesus paying for our atonement. Where Moses says, take me, blot me out of your book of life so that they may live. God says, no. Jesus says the same thing. My God, why have you forsaken me? And God says, yes. We're separated from God and yet God wants to be near. through the person of Jesus, he has come near. Love and justice at the cross are perfectly met. No better place than in John 1:14, the Word became flesh, that's Jesus, and tabernacled, skenao, tabernacled, a tent was pitched through the person of Jesus, and we saw his glory. The law was given through Moses, grace and truth through Jesus. No one has ever seen God. No one can see God and live, but the one and only Son, who himself is God and is in closest relationship with the Father, he has made him known. You know, if you're here tonight and you do have that sense that you're separated from God, you need to think about this right here. You feel like, I feel a little bit guilty. That's because you are guilty. I feel separated from God. That's because you are separated from God. Yeah, we're not born in a relationship with God. We're born separate. And what we're seeing here is that that could all be changed here tonight. You can come to know God through the person of Jesus just by asking, just by saying, God, I want to come to know you, because, not because of what I've done, but because of what you did through the person of Christ.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.